Well, joining us once again for his regular chat with Radio Yorkshire, and that's Mr. Ken Bates. Morning, KB.
Morning, Darren.
How are you?
A bit throaty, but we'll battle through.
We'll battle through. Good news. Good news. Lots to discuss today. Let's start with Leeds United and a first win of the season for Leeds down at Derby. And it's always been quite a difficult place for Leeds United to go to.
Yes, well, Derby is a compact ground. It has good gates. And they're very sort of... They really are worth an extra goal or an extra man to their team. And I think what Leeds haven't won there for years. So a really good result for the team and the club. And, of course, encouraging jump up the table. This makes life easier. And only just 6 points away from the top with 40 games to go. So looking good.
Looking very good indeed, really, unbeaten this season. And a very successful transfer window for Leeds United from all corners, being able to keep hold of Sam Byram. I'm sure there was a number of players that they missed out on. I'm just wondering, in your experience and in your history at Leeds and in Chelsea, during a transfer window, were there any players that you were really keen on getting into a club that you missed out on?
Well, not really. You know, it's difficult to think back over the last 30-odd years, but I think, first of all, this rush on the transfer window deadline, it's absolutely bloody ridiculous. I mean, to start with, you know, you sign a player on the transfer deadline day. You already played maybe 10% of your matches. He comes in. I mean, it's the same. He's their homegrown player, but they come in from overseas. It's a double problem. Cause do they speak the language? Do they know the custom and culture? If they're married. They've got to get their kids settled into schools that can handle foreign-speaking kids, so on and so forth. And, of course, then they've got to learn your training habits, your regime. You've got to meet your new fellow teammates. And you've got to get to know the manager and the coaches and the coaching system. So you can probably take off at least another month to settle in. So it's stupid. What we did at both Chelsea and Leeds, I mean, some of these transfers seem almost desperation transfers. We did Chelsea and Leeds, started discussing next season's team, and this season, after the ending of the January transfer window. Then started looking straight, reviewing every player in the club, their strengths, their weaknesses, what can we get out of them in the future? Are they going to fail us? So what do we need? And then in conjunction with the head chief scout, which is Gwyn Williams of both Chelsea and Leeds, of course, call him director of football these days, to see what's on the market and what's available to identify your targets. And you made discreet inquiries to the would-be selling club in confidence and put it through the newspapers before the transfer window opens at the end of the season. So we really know which ones are no-hopers, which ones are the clubs are interchangeable, which clubs are playing hard to get. We want to get maximum transfer fee, which is fair enough. And in the also, we've been quietly out to the... You have to wait until you say from relegation, or no, you're not going to be promoted, before you start talking to would-be outgoing players' agents, because obviously that feeds back to the player. And consequently, we used to do all our... The aim was to do all our transfer deals before the end of June, because then when the players report back for pre-season training... They come in, they've got 6-7 weeks to learn exactly what I was saying earlier. Mode of play, training routine, dietary, so on and so forth. And also if they come with a slight knock, you've got 7 weeks to get them right. See, in my own memory, I can't remember any hasty last minute signings because bears or a pig in a poke, and you pay over the odds. And this, I mean, this thing about, if you sell a, another thing, if you sell a player the last 2 or 3 days of the transfer window, what opportunity have you got to get a replacement, a satisfactory replacement? And if you do find one, then obviously you're held to ransom by the selling club, who knows you're desperate because you left it so late. Makes sense. Makes sense. And you have to remember, because you're both the players, you know, June and July, the players and the managers of the other clubs are often on holiday. So it's hard to contract them to do deals. You have to have that into consideration as well. And we always found, particularly at Chelsea, when we were in the first division, for example, or the old second division, as it was then, is that if you did those deals early, then you could sit back, knowing you've got the players, and they have time to think about it in good time. For example, they can come up and start looking at houses, for example, inquire. We'll always help them find their kids' schools and so on and so forth. And you do that, if you can do all that before they report for training, then you get them all settled in and more comfortable. And it's very important to make sure the wife, if the fella's single, or, you know, hasn't got, if he's got a partner or a wife, I want to get her happy and settled down. Because there's no screaming when you get home after training, because there's a home crisis, domestic crisis.
Interesting you say about players settling down, because in the papers in the last few days, the prospective sale of Sado Berrinho from West Brom to Spurs is certainly in the back pages, because he's refusing to play. He's on strike. He's been given a few days off. There's been some high profile ones over the years of players refusing to play. I just wanted to get your thoughts on that. Has that ever happened to you with a player in clubs that you've been in charge with at all? And what are your thoughts on players on strike?
Well, the players signed a contract, and it doesn't give them any right to strike or withhold their services at all. So first thing, obviously, you find them. Well, you try to get things sorted out quietly behind doors. You don't conduct it through the newspapers. But then, if you find the guy being in transition, then you obviously immediately fine him. So he's not working, he's not being paid. That's the first thing. And then you start, there are many other options that you can do. For example, you can withdraw all his privileges. And also, if necessary, you can suspend him from training with the first team. Or either make him train with the youth team, or far better, make him train on his own. And if he doesn't train, well, he's not keeping himself fit. So if he does get an eventual move, it then makes him unattractive to the club who may or may not want him. Well, I can remember one guy, this was when I was older, and he was a bit of a wanderer anyway, because we got him from a Sheffield club because he's protesting about, we didn't sort of incite him to leave. We moved in when he made it quite clear he wasn't going to give his best. And he was a prolific goal scorer. So we pulled him into Oldham. And the same thing happened about 8 months later. He got tapped up and wanted to move somewhere else. And we said no. He said we didn't really feel in the right frame of mind to play for the first team. So I said, well, that's okay. You can play in the reserves. If you don't know that, you can play in the A team. And you'd better go, and I took him over to show him the A team pitch, which is a landfill site we rented from the Oldham Council. And of course, there are all kinds of bits and things sticking up and down over it, which wouldn't do you any good if you landed on. So we left him to think about it, and eventually played. You've got, if you're the employer, you've got to be tough. You've got to be fair. It'll be tough. You've got to know who's the boss. Because otherwise, it's just anarchy in the club. And then they set an example. Players see one boy getting away with it, they think, well, they can too. And it's, and Peter Docherty said, he used to play for Manchester City and then finished at Hull. He said, yeah, one bad apple, you don't chuck it out, it contaminates the whole bowl. And that's what you've got to be. Firm, fair, but at the end of the day, you're the boss. You have to know it. The other thing you don't do finally is you never slag off your players in public or blame them. That Warnock, I never forgave Warnock. If you remember, we were playing Hull and Tom Lees got concussed. Probably came back a bit early. Made a mistake and gave away a goal. And Warnock would blast him in the aftermatch injury in public, slagging him off. Then cost us the game. And I think that ruined Lee's career at Leeds. In fact, I rang him on his club coach as they were coming home, telling him, take no notice of what Warnock said, it was disgraceful. He's a great player, had a great future. If you think about it, he was never the same man again. And he went to Sheffield, didn't he? But I think he's playing quite well. But what has to be said is in the dressing room and stays in the dressing room.
Yeah, dangerous and different time in football at the moment. Moving away from football, KB, and the news came out that the former Leeds United managing director David Haig was handed a 2-year jail sentence after being convicted of breach of trust by a court in Dubai.
I thought that was very interesting because he was originally charged with fraud, theft, misappropriation of funds, etc., 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 embezzlement, money laundering. And that hasn't been committed on. And breach of trust is a nice vague phrase. But I'm afraid Dave wrote me a letter from jail about 8-9 months ago. And he said, don't say I told you so. We had dinner with him in Chelsea. On the 10th of May last year, and he just came out of hospital, so he hadn't said anything about it. He turned out he had an operation, a tummy ulcer, and he was still recuperating. He couldn't eat solids, so he did have a very good mushroom soup at Marco's. And Suzanne and I entertained him. He was talking about his future and blah, blah, blah. And we both said to him then, don't go back to Dubai. He said, well, they've offered me that. Tell him to come to London to discuss it. Don't go back to Dubai. I urge you. It was the one topic comment. Don't go back to Dubai. Don't trust the bastard. And that was on the 10th of May. On the 17th of May, he caught the evening flight to Dubai. Went to his apartment, showered and changed. Put his suit on. Went to the office at 10 o'clock on the 18th of May. And the rest of say is history. If he hadn't been for Prisoners Abroad, which is a charity that looks after people like him, giving special food, etc., etc., because Dubai weren't doing anything about it at all, he probably died. So don't trust them. It's as simple as that. And he's talking about appealing. My advice to him is that the moment you're released, you grab your passport, then you can go back to your apartment, go straight to the airport and get on a plane and get out. You can still appeal from London. I mean, we might think of David Haig, da-da-da. I was reading in Sunday paper last Sunday about how courts behave in Dubai. First of all, let me explain. There's an English girl and a French man, and I think they were both working for an airline. And they first, when they got married, they met in India and got married in India, had a little boy, age 2. They then decided to go back and live in Dubai, which makes me think they were working for Emirates. But that's just speculation on my part. They went back there. Anyway, things changed. We don't know. But all of a sudden, she's charged by a Sharia court. You know, Sharia law, which if you remember, that idiot Patel tried to introduce to Leeds by banning alcohol from Ellen Road. That got shot down, but that gives an example of their twisted thinking. This woman has been without a proper trial, for she wasn't even there at the first couple of times. She'd been found in her absence, guilty of abusing the child, being unfaithful, not physically, but unfaithful to her husband in trying to belittle him, not obeying his instructions. And so, I mean, the British government knew absolutely nothing about it, and was only knowing about David Hague, other than prompting the Foreign Office to issue a warning to British women living in the UAE, in the event of a marriage breakdown, they'll face custody proceedings under Sharia law, irrespective of their religion or nationality, and the strict doctrine is discriminating against women, wives of the property of their husbands, and often the custodians of their children. And this woman hasn't seen her kid for 2 years, who's now 5, and she's unlikely to see him again until he's 18. I mean, the claim of the secret hearing, she ignored her evidence of what she drew her husband controlling behaviour, and said he cited her inability to breastfeed the child, the fact that the boy suffered from eczema, and she didn't obey her husband as proof that she was unfit to bring up her own son. And the final thing, listen to this, she actually sent her husband a happy Christmas text, and the court said that was an example of her being un-Islamic, despite she is a Christian, her husband is a Christian, and she herself is a non-practicing Muslim. And the British government have accepted this brand of justice as legitimate. Does that do to help? I mean, you know, main thing is, he's now served 15 months, so he's 24. I don't know if he gets any remission for good conduct, anything like that. I don't know the system out there. But as I'm saying, the day they release him, even in his prison clothes, grab his passport, which he hasn't surrendered, and run to the airport and get out, take a deep breath, and then start geofencing have assets in England, in Britain, and they're quoted on the stock exchange, so some funny way. So there's lots of things he can do, and revenge is a dish best eaten cold. So I suspect that, and then of course he can spill the beans on all the misdeeds of GFH, and I can suspect he can assist in them. The ultimate collapse is what they deserve. The various things that GFH did, the legacy they've left behind, are still a lot of messes that Massimo is trying to clear up very, very slowly. But of course, Massimo has also got his own problems, because he hasn't paid at least one of the firm of lawyers, and he is in dispute with Endeavour Insurance over unpaid contractual obligations. And, of course, there's a breach of contract case with Macron. So his hands are full at the moment. But still, apart from being knocked out of the League One, the Capital Cup, Leeds are unbeaten this year. So it's good on the playing side, good for the fans.
Finally, KB, before we move on to happier subjects with regards to the Radio Yorkshire box competition. We've seen some horrendous images in the papers today of the immigrant crisis and how Europe doesn't seem to be dealing with the problem at the moment. There's some really, really sad images we're seeing on the front pages of the papers today.
Yes, it is tragic, but I'm afraid we can't be the haven to the world's refugees, some of whom are economic migrants, and some of them are just seeking a better life. And I think that entire Europe has to be much tougher. In Syria and in Libya, and when they catch these people or save these people, they should be then taken back, put back into Libya, or put back into Turkey, or put back into Syria, or the Lebanon where they come from. But more importantly, they say, what should the British government should do, they should be spending money in trying to give them a better life in their own countries. And where this money could come from is a bloated $13.5 billion a year we give out in this overseas aid policy, which is hopefully mismanaged. For example, if we immediately cancelled all aid we paid, wait for it, China, India, Pakistan and Russia, all of whom are nuclear nations, all of whom are in one stage or the other, either in space or preparing to go in space, they're not hard up. What the hell are we subsidising them for? Why are British taxpayers giving money to those countries? So that should be stopped immediately, like overnight. Boom, knife stopped. All offices shut, people out. And that money should then be transferred into Africa, where it's needed. But again, we must be handing monies out to charities or quangos where the money dissipates. We should be putting our own people in there and supervising how the money is spent. My granddaughter took on a 3-month work experience to help one of the charities in the Sudan. You know, unpaid, they paid a fare out on accommodation. And she left after, came back after a month. I said, well, why is that, Plum? She said, Grandad, I was in a sort of a camp, enclosed camp, and I was sort of running errands, like arranging hair appointments and buying this and that and the other for some of the female staff there. I don't think I saw any Sudanese for the month I was there. She said, people living the life of Rani. She said, some of them are working hard. Awful lot of parasites. Having a ball. Tax-free. In a nice sunny climate. So it's like being generous, but this money has to be supervised and make sure it goes straight to the people that really need it, not the rip-off merchants and corrupt officials in between. I just think about it. They're organising a big dinner here in Monte Carlo. I heard it purely by chance. I was talking to the guy who runs Radio Riviera. And the pattern on the 3rd of October, they're having a 600 black tie dinner, obviously fundraising, for Chernobyl. Well, my son, who now lives in Italy, has practical experience of doing that. Because he and a group of others, we lived in Ireland, in a group of his friends, got together. And for 4 years, they raised the money locally, and they hired vans and lorries and trucks, and they drove all the way from the Kilkenny area in Ireland to Chernobyl, with blankets and food and medical supplies and so forth. And the incompetence and corruption and bribery took place on the Russian border and then the Chernobyl border to get through. On one occasion, they slept in their cab for 4 days before they finally went through, after having paid backsheesh. When they got there, and Richard, in fact, they found one kid had been abandoned, and Tamar, they brought him back with them and helped to bring him up. And he's now very successful in Russia. Sorry, in America. And still keeps in touch. But the point I'm getting at, there's an awful lot of good deeds done, but they're done by cutting out the quangos, the bureaucracy, and the civil service, and getting things done themselves. And that's the way we can help these people, so they don't, and also make it clear, like that, that Europe is not a golden era. and America, England, isn't, you know, an easy touch. It is, we know. No need to advertise it. I'll give an example, one just drifting on. Do you remember the Nepalese disaster? You know, the landslide and earthquake and everything else that caused all kinds of troubles there.
Yeah.
And the British Air Force immediately sent three big helicopters out to try and get stuff into inaccessible villages. The Nepalese government wouldn't allow them in. It's believed it was under pressure from China and Russia, fearing they would use cameras to film what was going on the out, you know, on the Russian-Chinese borders. So we brought them back. And then they're still launching these appeals to help the Nepalese. If the Nepalese won't help themselves, why should anybody else help them? That's the problem. And the other problem, of course, is that Europe, the EC, haven't got a plan to make out as they go along. And whether extra barbed wire and fences and all that kind of stuff is any good, I don't think so. What we should be doing, when we're catching traffickers, immediately the driver should be jailed and the vehicles should be confiscated. And if there's British traffickers, as is alleged, well, they should be arrested and jailed immediately and all their possessions should be seized.
Well, let's move on to happier subjects, KB. And
Yes, now let's talk about the oncoming game of Brentford.
Yes, because there's a chance that a few lucky listeners could be watching that match in a bit of luxury.
When's the closing date?
Closing date for this one is 9th of September.
6 days to go, but once again, folks, you like the transfer window. Don't leave it to the last day. Give us the details, don't.
Here we go. You can win a VIP match day experience at Elland Road in our corporate box alongside an exquisite three-course meal, of course. You just need to answer this question. Which Leeds United head coach has also been manager at Brentford FC? Is it A, Darko Milinic, B, Uwe Rosler, or C, Neil Redfern? If you know, then text DAB and your answer, A, B or C, to 84383. Text costs £1 plus your standard message rate. Entries to the competition close the 9th of September and the winners will be chosen shortly after. So good luck with that.
And of course, Darren, as I said last week, I know the answer to that one. What you should point out is the employees of the station and of Leeds United Football Club, their immediate family, are disqualified.
Quite right. I was upset. I've already applied to go, so that's me out already. Never mind.
So they are fans. For a quid, you're going to have a £300 day out. It's not a bad return.
That's pretty good.
You have a go. And good luck.
KB, as ever, an absolute pleasure chatting. We'll chat again next week.
Thank you, Darren. Bye-bye.